Let me encourage you to do something that I was encouraged to do last year by a good friend who's sitting over there, and he said, "What's your word for the year?" I go, "Word? I have pages for the year." He goes, no, "What's the word for a year?" And I go, "You can't put a year in a word." But then as I was studying the Gospel of John, John put the whole gospel in a word, didn't he? Believe. He put the whole gospel in one word. What's a word that will take you through this year? Think about it. So our family was talking about it even the other day, and we're going to share it with each other later this week as we get together again, what our word for the year is. And think through that. A word you can remember, a word you can put on your mirror, in your books, on your computer as you open it up. What is that word that you're asking God to do in your life or the life of your family? And maybe it's two words, but find that reason to live this year and put it down in writing and pray for that and tell someone else so that they can pray for you as well. Will you do it? Take what you prayed today and put it together so that you can remember it, not go, "Oh, it's March now and I forgot," but remember it, because this year could be an incredible year. And we're going to look in the Gospel of John today. And it's a terrible time in the Gospel. You know, there's the good parts of the Gospel and there's the bad parts of the Gospel. Chapter 19 of the Gospel of John is the bad part of the Gospel from a human standpoint. And I was thinking, turn to it if you have your Bibles, John 19. I was thinking about it, I thought, why would I do the bad part on the last day of the year? Well, we're preaching through it and we're walking through the whole book, and God determined it long ago. I was hoping to be done with the Gospel of John by the end of the year so we could move on. We won't be done for a couple more weeks, probably into middle of January. But this is the day, John chapter 19, and I'd like us to look at it today. Actually, I want to begin with a few verses before 19, if I could. We left the story of Jesus with Pontius Pilate last week and the previous weeks. Jesus was talking with Pontius Pilate. And it's important to know something, and I want to give you just some details around this story, because we're going to the crucifixion today. We're going to the cross. We know the story of the cross, and I want to give context around the story because John gives context. First of all, it's important to know that Pontius Pilate did not live in Jerusalem. He lived in a place called Caesarea, which was the capital at that point of the Roman region, what we call Israel. They called Palestine back then. But he was visiting Jerusalem because it was Passover, and they were afraid there was going to be some problems, as there usually was when everybody got together. They had kind of an anti-Roman flavor in Israel. And so he would always come to Jerusalem and stay in a place called Antonio's Fortress, which was on the north side of the temple area. And that was where he stayed. And that's where he met with Jesus at this point in time. And we saw that last week. And we pick up the story at the end of verse 38. And Pilate said of chapter 18, excuse me, just preceding where we left, Pilate asked Jesus, "What is truth?" And that's where I ended the sermon last week. And so you can go back and you can look at that. But let's move forward. After he had said this, he went back outside to the Jews. That's outside of this fortress. He actually had a fortress there that Herod had built before him, so they had some pinnacles in it, so they could see into the temple to make sure there wasn't an insurrection happening. They're actually spying on the Jews. So that's where he was staying. That's where this was at. And that's why there were so many Jews around, because it was right adjacent to the Temple Mount area. And so he's there. He goes back out, and all the Jews are there. And he told them, "I find no guilt in Jesus. But you have a custom that I should release one man for you at Passover. So do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews?" And they cried out again, "Not this man, but Barabbas." Now Barabbas was a robber. Have you ever thought about who Barabbas was? I think it's important to understand, how did that name Barabbas just come on the lips of these people? I mean, do we know everybody who's in jail? No, we don't. But why did we know Barabbas? The reason is because I believe there was an insurrection or a revolution that was being contemplated by a group of people led by three people: Barabbas and the two unnamed men who were on the cross with Jesus. You see, those three crosses were already prepared. That middle cross was for a man who was in charge of the insurrection who was trying to take over Jerusalem, and his name was Barabbas. And everybody knew it, and probably what happened is that Pontius Pilate had a trial for Barabbas and condemned him to death with the two unnamed men as well. The three of them, they were going to die. Everybody knew that Barabbas was the instigator of this insurrection. Your Bible may say robber. It's not a robber in the sense of larceny or burglary. It's robbing from Rome. He probably did rob things to support his insurrection, but they wanted to take back the city of Jerusalem from the Romans as their forebears had taken it back, the Maccabees, from the Syrians. I talked about that a week or two ago. And so Barabbas, so he certainly knew that these people would not want Barabbas. He was an evil man. He had been condemned to death. And so it was a real easy decision to go, do you want Jesus, the guy who fed the 10,000, 5,000 and who did all these miracles and all this, or do you want this very evil man? And they shouted out, give us Barabbas. He was not expecting that answer. He thought his problems were over when he said, do you want this man who's done nothing except maybe upset a few religious leaders, or do you want this man who was an evil man who was about to go to death in 3 hours from now? It's somewhere between 9 o'clock and noon at this point. We're not quite sure the exact moment of time. They were going to crucify him sometime in that time frame because they had to get him off by 3 or 4 o'clock so they could go back to Passover and have him all done before sundown. And so he's on his way, and they said, give us Barabbas. It's important to know that Pontius Pilate now is in a pretty tough place because he thought Jesus shouldn't go to crucifixion. That's Pontius Pilate. Now let's pick up the story. 19 verse 1. Then Pilate took Jesus and flogged him. Let me just pause for a minute. Today's a family service, so there's a little noise here today because we have our nurseries closed. So moms and dads, as long as they're not too bad, keep them here. But we do have a family room downstairs with it piped in. If they keep screaming, take them out. If you're okay, keep them here as well, because we all have kids, grandkids, nieces, and nephews, and we know what it's like. So that's just a little aside for today. We go back next week to our regular children's community groups, etc. Back to the Bible. And the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on Jesus's head and arrayed him in a purple robe. They came up to him saying, "Hail the King of the Jews," and struck him with their hands. Pilate went out again and said to them, "See, I am bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no guilt in him." Pontius Pilate wanted nothing to do with the death of Jesus at this point. So Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and purple robe. Pilate said to him, to them, "Behold the man." Incredible words, "Behold the man." Later on, they say, "Behold your king." But here he says, "Behold the man." When the chief priests and officers saw him, they cried out, "Crucify him, crucify him." Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him." That's the third time that he says, "I don't find him guilty." The Jews answered him, "We have a law," verse 7, "and according to that law, he ought to die because he's made himself the Son of God." When Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid. He entered into his headquarters again and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" Remember, Jesus had said he had a kingdom and his kingdom was not of this world, last chapter. Where are you from? So Pilate said to him, you will not speak? Jesus didn't give him an answer. Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you? And Jesus answered him, you would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given to you from above. Now it's important, if I may pause there, I've said this every time I talk about the crucifixion, who killed Jesus? A lot of people were involved, including those people in this room, but it was God and Jesus who allowed himself to be killed. And so don't be pointing fingers unless you're going to point them to yourself as to why Jesus died, because Jesus says even here, you have no authority except because of the Father, even the authority of life and death. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin. And from then on, Pilate sought to release Jesus, but the Jews cried out, if you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar. We read through that part very quickly, but it's important to understand that, you know, a little history here, that the Caesars that we know, the names of them, Julius Caesar, Caesar Augustus, these were incredibly powerful men who brought the kingdoms together into the Roman Empire. Following them, the rest of the Caesars were far less powerful and far more worried that people were trying to take over their kingdom, like Nero, who would be coming here in about 15 years after this point, and some of the others. They were scared to death. So the last thing that Pontius Pilate wanted to be told to the Caesar is that he's going against the Caesar. In the past, it wouldn't matter because the Caesar was the greatest. Now the Caesars were being, there was insurrections going on because everybody wanted to be Caesar. And so he did not want some Jewish tradesmen to travel to Rome and tell the Romans in Rome that your guy in Israel or Palestine is against Caesar. So that was kind of the nuclear option there. When they said that, Pontius Pilate said, okay, he's all yours. It was over at that point. So verse 13, so when Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out and set him on the judgment seat called the stone pavement in Aramaic, Gabbatha. Now it was the day of preparation. It was about the sixth hour, and he said to the Jews, behold your king. This is hugely important to understand. Though he was mocking Jesus, he was actually telling the truth when he said, behold the man and behold your king. And they cried out, away with him, away with him, crucify him. Pilate said to them, shall I crucify your king? And the chief priests answered, we have no king but Caesar. Again, that nuclear option back then. So he delivered him over to be crucified. And it was at that point that Barabbas was released and Jesus was heading to Golgotha. Let's continue in verse 17. So they took Jesus and he went out bearing his own cross to the place called the place of the skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. In Latin, it's called Calvary. They were there, they crucified him with two others, one on either side and Jesus between them. The other gospels tell us about those two men. This one doesn't. Pilate wrote the inscription and put it on the cross. It read, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. Now here's what would happen. When Jesus, or anyone in this case, who was being crucified, was crucified, they would walk with their crossbeam, most likely, not the whole cross, but just the crossbeam. There's a long Latin name for that I can't pronounce, but that part, it would weigh somewhere around 100 pounds, and they would carry it, and that's what Jesus was carrying it, and usually in front of him would be a Roman guard, and then there would be four guards around him, and the man in front would give the reason why this man is being crucified. because he's a robber, he's a murderer, he's an insurrectionist, whatever it may be. And in this case, it said, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. He did it in three languages, so everyone there, all the Passover participants who were there, could see who Jesus was and read it in the language that was most likely their mother tongue of the three languages. So he's carrying, much like you see at a wedding with a little child saying, here comes the bride nowadays, a little carrying that, and then here's Jesus carrying the crossbeam with four guards around him. Many of the Jews read this inscription, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and it was written in Aramaic, which was kind of the Hebrew of the day, kind of the vernacular, in Latin and in Greek. So the chief priests of the Jews said to Pilate, do not write the King of the Jews, but rather that this man said, I am the King of the Jews. And Pilate said, finally Pilate said, enough already. What I have written, I have written. And then it goes on to talk about the soldiers divided and threw lots for his garments. Let's pick up the story in verse 25. But standing by the cross of Jesus were his mother and his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. Now, in Greek, and I'm not a Greek scholar, I barely passed Greek in school, but they don't do commas the same way we do in English. So the question is that four women or three women? And whoever you read, everybody says something different. There's his mother, Mother Mary, we know her, and his mother's sister, and in your Bible and mine, there's a comma, and it says Mary, the wife of Clopas. Was Mary, the wife of Clopas, the sister of Mary, the mother of Jesus, or is that another person? Is the sister and Mary another person? I can't give you the answer to that, so I don't know if there were three women there in this line or four women. I believe there were four women. That's my personal view. I believe there was Mary, the mother of Jesus. There was her sister, and her sister was actually Salome, who's probably the mother, the wife of Zebedee, and the mother of John and James. So the writer of this book, John, is actually probably a cousin of Jesus. That's what most people think, but there's nothing in the Bible that tells us that. It's extra biblical materials that tell us. Then there was Mary, the wife of Clopas. We don't know who Clopas was, but that lady was there, and Mary Magdalene. Why were these ladies there? I believe they were there, one, because they were believers in Jesus, but two was they were there to comfort Mary, the mother, at it. They were there. Everybody else was afraid. The only other person that was there was, of course, when Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby. That's John, the writer of this book. So there was either three or four women and John standing right there. Now, let me do away with one of the misconceptions of crucifixion. We have a song in our hymnology of church that talks about the hill of Calvary. On a hill far away stood an old rugged cross. That is a great song, but it's not biblical. It wasn't far away, and it wasn't on this like mountain. You always think of this huge mountain. It says it's the place of the skull. It doesn't say the mountain. You know, there's not a mountain there. Jerusalem is built on mountains, but there's not a mountain next to it. I've been to Jerusalem many, many times. There's little knolls and hills, meaning 20, 30 feet high, but not these mountains, and there's the cross way up there, or the three crosses. It actually was done on a road. They wanted you to walk by normally to see that these people, whoever they were, not just Jesus, was being crucified for some wrong. They put it there, and that's why they would put on it what they did. And there, so you could walk. And the other is, they weren't as tall as you think. They were probably just a few, maybe even a foot taller than the person, so they couldn't stand on their feet. They were elevated. But you're looking eye to eye, or maybe up a little, to these people. It was incredibly heinous to watch. because you are right there. You literally are walking. Now you ask, where was it? There's two places that they say, a little to the west, which is where the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is today, and that's where some say it is, or a little to the north, Gordon's Calvary, and that's where they say it is. I've been to both, and I teeter, which it's not important that we actually know the exact location where it is, but it was on a road. There was road to the west. There was road to the north. It would have been right there, and these roads are paths where people walk. So you're walking right by. So they are literally right there. So Jesus is talking to John and to Mary as closer than I am to the front row here. I mean, it's that close. It's not as we see in the movies that they're way up there and the people are way back here. So you need to understand how close it is. And then, great verses. When Jesus saw his mother and the disciple, verse 26, whom he loved, standing nearby, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." Now, what Jesus was doing was saying it to John. "Mother, woman, behold your son." Then he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." Jesus, in this point in time when he's about to die, is taking care of his earthly mother. It is a beautiful scene where he turns the mother, Mary, over to John. And John, it says there, and from that time on, the disciple took her into his own home. So it was interesting. She didn't get to the other children or to some cousin. Well, he probably was a nephew. And Jesus gave her to John. It's beautiful. After this, Jesus, knowing that all was now finished. I want you to underline that, if you would. After this, Jesus, knowing that all was now finished. This is an incredible verse here. He knew that the work that he had done was done. And he was about to die, and it was over. At least this part of the story was over. So to fulfill the scripture, he said, "I thirst." And I want you to underline the "I thirst," because this brings in these incredible contrasts. Now you have Mary, her sister, Mary Clopas, and Mary Magdalene, who we've known from before. I won't describe Mary Magdalene. They're all there. John's there. And they're there. Probably some others are behind them that are unmentioned. And he says, "I thirst." Does that bring back anything to you? Do you remember in John chapter 4, Jesus said, "I am the living water, and anybody drinks from me will never thirst again"? And then Jesus says, "I thirst." There is a dissonance going on here. There's a problem going on here. "I thirst," but Jesus said, "I am the living water." There's another dissonance here. Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, yet he's on a cross. Jesus said, "I am a king, and I have a kingdom," and yet he's on a cross. Another dissonant thing happening. This is tough. Let me give you another one. Jesus says, "I am the light of the world," throughout the Gospel of John, and yet there was darkness that came over the earth, didn't there? So Jesus says, "I am the living water." He says, "I'm thirsty." "I'm the king." Pilate wasn't the only one who said he was a king. Jesus said he was a king, yet he's on a cross, the most humble, humiliating, excruciating, painful experience, yet he's a king. "I am the light of the world," versus darkness. And then he had just said to the disciples, which I believe, of course, John was there, probably Mary, his mother, was there, maybe the others were even there. He said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." He said, "I am the life." And he also said to Mary and Martha, another Mary, said, "I am the resurrection and the life," didn't he? And then he's about to die. So what does it mean, "I am the life," and he's dead? "I am light," and there's darkness. "I am the living water," and he's thirsty. This is pretty difficult. Now, you and I know the rest of the story. They do not know the rest of the story. You need to realize that they didn't know, as much as Jesus told them he would rise in 3 days and all those things, they didn't get that. They didn't understand that. this man, their leader, her son, was about to die. And all the things he had said were dying with him. This is a pretty sad moment in the history of the world. I would venture to say the saddest moment in the history of the world. Because everything Jesus claimed was going down the tubes. We must realize it's not, oh, he died and then he rose again. With his death, all the claims he made went with him. And you could name more than I just named four of them. And then he drank a little sour wine. And then in verse 30, when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, "It is finished." And he bowed his head and gave up the spirit. And he was dead. There's a beautiful analogy back to the Old Testament story of the Passover. When the guards came to check on them, they usually would break their legs so they couldn't breathe. You've all heard that story. Their legs were crossed like this, and there's even some old bones where they found the nails through the 2 feet, not of Jesus, of course, but other people that have been crucified. And if you break their bones, they can't breathe. You and I don't realize it, but you lift your diaphragm up to breathe, even when you're sitting. And if you can't lift, you're going to suffocate. So they wanted to get these guys off so they could go to the Sabbath and Passover. So they were going to break his leg. They realized he was dead. And it fulfilled the prophecy from back in Exodus chapter 12, where the first Passover lamb could not have any broken bones. Jesus died without a broken bone. It's an amazing connection to the Jewish Passover, to this death. Now, verse 35 is key, and I want you to underline it because it is placed here in a very tough place, or a place I wouldn't have put it. John gives a statement. John's the writer of this book, the disciple who Jesus loved, and he gives a statement. It's like it should be in parentheses because it's kind of outside the storyline. He who saw it has borne witness. His testimony is true, and he knows that he is telling the truth that you also may believe. Where did that come from? We're talking about this whole storyline. He's going to get back into the storyline in the next verse, and he stops and says, I just want to tell you, everything I have just told you is true. In fact, it is the truth. I'm bearing witness to the truth, and the purpose that I just told you this is that you may believe. Why did he say that? The reason is because all the people that were there were dead at this point in time. This gospel was written dozens of years later. Mary was gone. These were all people that were old enough to be John's mothers. They're all gone. They're dead. The eyewitnesses have died. John's a young disciple, one of the youngest ones. Now he's an older man. He writes this gospel, and he just says, I'm telling you the truth. This is the way it is. This is the way it is. It's not second generation. It's not third generation. I am a first generation person who saw this. That's why he talked about being right there, probably 10 feet away from the crucifixion. We see this today. You know, World War II, to most of you in this room, is a historical fact. But to some of you in this room, it's a personal reality, isn't it? The personal reality is going away because most who were in World War II are dead or dying. They're in their 80s, their 90s, early hundreds. There's not many left. And when you want to talk about the Holocaust, you want to talk about the Battle of the Bulge, you want to talk about the Pacific, these are all things that when I was growing up, everybody around me had been in it. And I heard firsthand all these stories. I'd grab hold of them. Now it's history. And anybody can say anything about history. The fools that say the Holocaust didn't exist, the people that say this, they can say anything they want because the eyewitnesses are almost gone. And John's saying, people, I'm an eyewitness. I just want you to know, this is what happened. You're reading an eyewitness account. It's an incredible thing. So he just kind of puts it right in the middle, and he says, I'm telling you this because I want you to believe. And he tells us next chapter, which we'll get to next week, why he wants us to believe, because in believing you shall have eternal life. But we'll get to that next week. For these things, verse 36, took place that the scriptures might be fulfilled, that not one of his bones will be broken. It's like he talks about them not breaking his bones, goes right into this, hey, I'm an eyewitness. Then he goes back to a storyline. And he puts it right in the middle of the story because there are people even back then who said Jesus didn't die on the cross. Oh, he fainted, he swooned, he this, he that. He's saying he died. This man was dead. And I am here to tell you, John says. Verse 38. Two more people that are minor characters, but I think very major in the story. A man we didn't know anything about, another man we had heard once before. After these things, Joseph of Arimathea. He says Joseph of Arimathea because there's other Josephs, like Mary's husband Joseph, and there's other Josephs in the Bible. This one's from Arimathea, a small town to the north of Jerusalem. He's a member of the Sanhedrin, which is the ruling class. He's upper class. Who was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly for fear of the Jews. So there are secret believers. Nicodemus was probably one of them. Certainly Joseph of Arimathea was one of them. They were secret believers. What are they doing when Jesus is being crucified? They're going to Pilate and asking him for the body. Their secret is outed. Now, if it were me, okay, or you, if the person you followed who said all these great things and the opposite occurred and I was a secret follower of this person, I might keep it a secret for a little longer. But these two men chose to be outed, and they just didn't tell their neighbor. They told Pilate, who had the ability to kill him. And they went to him and said, well, let's read it. They asked Pilate if they might take away the body of Jesus, and Pilate gave them permission. So he came and took away his body. Nicodemus also, who earlier had come to Jesus by night, John chapter 3, so we do realize that Nicodemus became a believer, so two high-ranking Sanhedrin. So we can't say that all the Jews hated Jesus. It's ridiculous. These are two leading Jews of the community that loved Jesus, that believed in Jesus, and who were willing to come out for it. Quick aside, that's important to understand. It's okay to love Jesus in this room, isn't it? When Clay's up here and we're praying and we're getting down on our knees and we're asking God and invoking God. But do you tell people out there? Do you ever tell people out there that you're a believer? Do you talk about Jesus out there? I've told this story many times. I remember when I was in business, I had written a letter or some planning, actually year-end planning, and at the end of it, I talked about some spiritual things I was planning. I put it on the 35th page of this document, and I sent it to the president of the company, and his secretary called me in tears, saying, I'm a Christian. She obviously had read my document. I'm a Christian, and I've never told anybody here. Now, I was glad she was a Christian, and I'm glad she was moved, but I was saddened that she'd been with a company for a dozen years, and no one in the company knew she was a Christian. She had never outed herself. Can I just say, get out of the closet, get out of church, and tell people you are a believer in Jesus Christ, and there is a reason for it, and tell them why. Don't be afraid. If Joseph of Arimathea, who could have had himself been locked up at that moment in time as an insurrectionist, as a follower of this dead rabbi, Nicodemus, and so they came, and this is what they did. They brought myrrh and alloys, 75 pounds. Some of your Bibles say 100 pounds. A pound wasn't, exactly the number of ounces it is now. So between 75 and 100 pounds. So think of it. Nicodemus is carrying 100 pounds to this tomb, and Joseph of Arimathea has taken this man. I don't know how much Jesus weighed, but it was at least 150, 175 pounds. Maybe John helped him, taking him to the tomb as well. This was no easy task because there weren't a lot of people helping him at this point in time. And they now in they put him in linen. Now, let me just describe what happens here. We think of the Egyptian mummification when we think of linen and all that. That's not what they did. The Jews did not mummify or embalm as we think of the way the Egyptians did. What the Jews did was they wrapped them in, if I could use this word to remind us of Christmas, swaddling clothes, of strips of material, and then would put alloys so that the smell, the putrefaction of, would not smell. So it wasn't an embalming, it was more a hiding of the smells. They're wrapping him and wrapping him and wrapping him. And then it says it's in a new tomb. Why is it important that it was a new tomb? Because this is the way the Jews did it for centuries. They would take a tomb. So if I was a wealthy person, as Joseph of Arimathea was, you had a tomb, which was your crypt for your family. Usually placed a stone in the middle of it, so it had to be at least 6 foot long or longer and a little wide. And you would lay this person with all the wrappings down. And they would close it off with a stone. Said it rolled the stone. They would close it with a stone and allow the decay to occur. He's not embalmed, so he decays. And when the decay occurred, this is the Jewish way, when the decay occurred, they'd come back, and I don't know how long that takes in Israel with all the dry stuff and everything, but a year or two or three, they'd come back, bones are left, then they would take the bones and put it in a box. It's called a bone box, or an ossuary, or a sarcophagus box, and it was only as long as the longest bone in the person's body. So if it were me, it would be this bone here, that would be how long my box would be. If it was a child or someone who was shorter, smaller boxes. They would put all the bones in the box, they would set it in the corner of the crypt, and when the next person in the family died, they'd do the same thing, put him or her onto the stone, and the same thing would happen. And then a couple years later, they'd come back, put them in a box, there'd be a second box there. You see what I'm saying? So there could be three or four boxes in the crypt. This was a new one. No one could say that they stole the bones of Jesus. There were no bones in the crypt to be stolen, someone else's bones. This was a brand new tomb. And the stone was rolled to stop the smell of it. It's a beautiful picture. It was in a garden. Where was it? It said adjacent to it. So we don't know, again, whether it was where they say it is and by the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, or where they say it is by Gordon's Calvary. We're not sure exactly where it is, but it was there. Some say, they actually know where it is. In fact, many people say they do. I'm not so convinced. I've read books on it. I've studied it. I even met with the eminent scholar, a Jewish scholar, who studies these things while in Jerusalem, and I still don't know the exact point of where it is, and I don't think it's important that I do know, because he's not there, is he? But they didn't know that. We're going to stop right there. End of story. They didn't know it. Next week, we'll find out what happens. What I want you to do now is turn to Lamentations chapter 3. Lamentations chapter 3. The darkest point in the history of Israel in the Bible times was when the people were taken out of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem was destroyed, 586 BC. It was actually started about 120 years before that, and these kingdoms were coming in one after the other and just beginning to destroy Israel. And finally, in 586 BC, Nebuchadnezzar and his teams took everybody away. It was the worst time in the history of the Jewish people to that point. Jeremiah is writing. He is depressed. He's known as the weeping prophet. Lamentations is the most depressing book in the Bible if you read it. It's a lament. It's a funeral dirge. And in it, starting in verse 7, he's praying to the Lord. Jeremiah the prophet, good man, praying to the Lord. And this is what he's saying. He, the Lord, the he in this is the Lord, the I is Jeremiah. He has walled me about so that I cannot escape. He has made my chains heavy. Though I call and I cry for help, he shuts out my prayer. I just wonder if any of you who were praying this morning on your knees felt God was shutting you out of your prayers. Any one of you might have said, I don't think he's going to answer this prayer. I don't think he hears my prayers. You are not alone. Jeremiah was with you on this. He has blocked my ways with blocks of stone. Jeremiah is saying every which way he went, he was blocked. And then he says at the end of verse 9 something that is so contrary to who God is. He says this, he has made my paths crooked. Does that recall a verse? Proverbs 3, 5 and 6, where it says that the Lord, trust in the Lord and he will make your paths straight. Jeremiah knew Solomon's words in the Proverbs, where God says, if you trust in me, I will make your path straight. And Jeremiah says, I have trusted in you, and you've made my path crooked. That is a picture of God abandoning him. Go down to verse 16. He, God, has made my teeth grind on gravel and made me cower in ashes. My soul is bereft of peace, without peace. I have forgotten what happiness is. So I say my endurance has perished, and so has my hope from the Lord. This is a prophet of God who's saying he has no hope. So I say to you right now, if you're here and you have no hope, listen to the rest of this, because there is hope in this. Some of you have lost loved ones this year. Some of you have lost relationships. Some of you have lost businesses. Some of you have just lost hope in life itself. And you're entering into 2018 in a very bad way. Verse 19, remember my affliction, O Lord. Remember my wanderings, the wormwood and the gall. My soul continually remembers it and is bowed down within me. He is just so depressed, so distraught. And then verse 21 comes. But this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. So in all that lack of hope, Jerusalem is destroyed. Everybody has been taken away. He's there with the remnant of the poor and the elderly, and they can't support themselves, and everything has gone wrong. And this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. And this is it. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. That is the hope of the faith which you and I have. Our faith is in Jesus Christ. Our belief is that we will have eternal life. But our hope is in that the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. The real word is there is never cut off. If you feel you have been cut off from God, it is not so. If you are a believer, God is there because his steadfast love never is cut off. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. This is a beautiful thing. God only promises you a day. Isn't that the truth? None of us is promised tomorrow. But if he gives you tomorrow, his mercies are new first thing tomorrow morning. So whatever happens today, tomorrow morning, his mercies can flood over you because his love is steadfast. That is the beauty of this. They are new every morning. And then he says these words, Great is your faithfulness. Or in the old way, great is thy faithfulness. We sing that song. What he's saying is not his faithfulness, but God's faithfulness is great. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I will have hope in him. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the soul who seeks him. There is an aspect to this that we just don't understand. Mary and Mary Clopas and the disciples and John and Joseph and Nicodemus buried their hope on that Friday afternoon. Their hope was gone. But as we will discover, it wasn't gone, was it? Now, lastly, I want you to turn over a few books to a book you never go to, Habakkuk, and we're going to close with this verse. Habakkuk, another prophet who was a lesser-known prophet during the time of the exile and the time of the taking of Jerusalem. He was a little before Jeremiah. Can you look at the last three verses of the book of Habakkuk? Only three chapters, so it's chapter 3, verse 17. And I'm going to put, if you can't get to it or you just can't find it, can't spell the word, I get it. I'm going to put it up here because these are some of the most important verses in the entire Bible. And I want you to get it because these verses relate exactly to where Joseph of Arimathea, Nicodemus, the disciples were all at that Friday afternoon when they closed the tomb. They closed the tomb and death had victory for that moment in time. Though the fig tree, chapter 3, verse 17, and it's up on the passage just to look at it. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit beyond the vines, the produce of the olive trees fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls. That's a pretty bad day for these people, isn't it? Everything is gone. Their vineyards, their animals, everything they hold dear is gone and destroyed. Yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God the Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. The picture we don't get, but let me give you the picture as we conclude. Have you ever seen in the Rocky Mountains a mountain sheep? What are they? They're up in these incredibly steep mountains, right? And they're there, and you go, how can they do that? If I went up there, I'd fall over, right? They can be there because of their feet, because they have the feet that allows them in these crags. And so in Israel, they have the same thing. I've seen them. You go to Israel out in the desert, they're not as high as the Rockies, but they have these wadis and these various things. And all of a sudden, you'll see a sheep, or more likely than a sheep, you see a deer. They call them lynx over there and different names. And you see them on these sheer cliffs with just little things because their feet can hold on. Their hoofs can hold on. And Habakkuk says, God gives us the hoofs to hold on when there's nothing but cliff in front of you. Your tennis shoes won't hold you. Your balance won't hold you. It's God giving you the feet. It's a picture of God helping you through the cliffs and ledges of life. And God promises that he will do it. And the joy that comes is that tomorrow his mercies are new. It took 3 days for them to see it, and we're going to come back to that in John chapter 20. But tomorrow is a new year, isn't it? January 1st, 2018. Who could have imagined 2018? Do not enter 2018 the way you enter 2017. I don't care how you enter 2017, but 2018, enter it with the joy of the Lord, the hope of the Lord, because he has given you the feet to walk through it, through the good and the not so good. Do you believe that? And it will be a great year because the blessing of God is on us. His steadfast love never fails. Great is your faithfulness. He doesn't say he's going to give us all the money in the world. You may not win that lottery. You may not get that promotion. Someone in your family may die. Absolutely. But he's going to help you and me walk through it. Do you believe that? That is the hope of this year that comes. Come back next week, and we're going to find out what that hope is in chapter 20 of John. Let's pray together.